You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Kim Barker had no experience as a foreign correspondent before she decided to move overseas to become the Chicago Tribune's South Asia Bureau Chief from 2004 to 2009. She chronicles her years covering the region after the U.S. military moved on to Iraq and gives a humorous, honest account of her life as a reporter in a chaotic land in her memoir, The Taliban Shuffle, Strange Days in Afghanistan and Pakistan. It's published by Doubleday, and I'm very pleased that it brings Kim Barker to our show today. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me here.
As I said, you never worked as a foreign correspondent before you went to Afghanistan, so what made you want to go overseas to report in one of the most dangerous places in the world?
Well, I honestly volunteered to go overseas before I had ever even been to Europe. I barely had a passport. But I was also a very good reporter, I'd like to think, and I knew where the biggest story in the world was, which was in Afghanistan and Pakistan after 9/11. So I volunteered. I walked into the foreign editor's office, and I said, this is my pitch. I'm single. I have no kids, so therefore I'm expendable. So you can send me, which they bought. They sent me to Pakistan first.
But wasn't Iraq now the big story?
At that particular time? No, it was this was in January of 2002 when I first went overseas. So it was right after 9/11 that I first volunteered.
And you went to Pakistan?
I went to Pakistan.
What was that like? And did you already see connections between what was going on in Afghanistan and Pakistan?
Well, I had read a lot, but, you know, it takes a while of being on the ground to actually understand how the two countries interplay with each other. When I first went to Pakistan in January of 2002, I was convinced that I wasn't going to be taken advantage of. So I had found out how much it was supposed to cost in rupees to get from the airport to the hotel. And I went outside and I said, no, 250 rupees, no more, no more. And finally, I got one guy with a broken down cab who agreed to take me. And we get to the cab and I go to get in and he just looks at me and he says, what, you're going to drive too? Because, of course, I was getting into the wrong side of the vehicle because I was so inexperienced in foreign travel.
And they have the British rules of the
exactly,
road.
Exactly, exactly.
Well, you write about being naive in all sorts of ways. And when you arrived in Afghanistan, you got yourself banned from a hotel for a while.
Oh, yeah. And in my first trip there, I forgot my money. You know, that was the first January 2002 as well. I got there and I asked a guy from the World Food Program, hey, where's the nearest cash station? And he had to explain to me that there were in no way, shape or form cash stations in a war zone. But I use a lot of these sort of amusing anecdotes and self-deprecating stories to be able to hook people so they'll actually follow through the entire book. Because believe it or not, I wrote this book in large part out of fury rather than thinking it was a very funny place to be for those years.
Fury for what reason?
Fury for several reasons. Fury with seeing what had happened in Afghanistan and Pakistan over the years I was there. These countries I very much grew to love and very much grew to love the people there. And fury with what had happened to the newspaper industry. I mean, in essence, I lost my job covering the war on terror while I was overseas.
Because the Chicago Tribune was going through really serious financial times.
Yes.
And it was bought by somebody who had nothing to do with the newspaper business.
Right.
And he appointed somebody who had nothing to do with the newspaper business to run the Trib. And also, was it the L.A. Times?
The L.A. Times, the Baltimore Sun, a number of Fort Lauderdale's newspaper, a number of very excellent newspapers are in the Tribune chain. And, you know,
Were you getting other kinds of messages from Chicago? We'd like this kind of coverage rather than that kind of coverage?
Well, I was getting the message that I should try to keep things local as much as possible. I mean, that was very much the message we all got. Let's, you know, it's local is important. Local news is important. Well, it's very difficult doing local stories when you are in Afghanistan and Pakistan. So I did find myself at one occasion and at the Super Bowl in 2009, actually covering the delivery of Chicago pizzas to Illinois troops and writing about that at like 4 a.m. at one point and watching the Super Bowl with the pizza.
So they always wanted the American angle.
Well, at that point, they did. I mean, in the very beginning, they didn't. I mean, I think everybody was trying to figure out at a certain point, what can we do to make people buy the newspaper? And so that was seen as one attempt to make people buy the newspaper, keep everything as local as possible.
So you arrived in the area. You were in Pakistan. You wound up going to India as your base?
Yes, yes.
That was the safest area, I would assume, New Delhi.
Yeah, and that was where I moved in June of 2004, and I was essentially based there, but I spent most of my time traveling between Pakistan and Afghanistan. I would kind of fly home for a pit stop, change clothes, pay everybody there, maybe, you know, get my hair cut on occasion, and then I would take off again.
How did the U.S. invasion of Iraq affect what was going on in Pakistan and Afghanistan?
At that particular time, that was March of 2003, and I happened to be sent to Afghanistan to cover Afghanistan when the focus switched to Iraq. And at that point in time, I really got a view of what it was going to be like for the next few years. I mean, Afghans felt very much like they had been completely abandoned, like there was no chance the country had at that point, and that nothing would change. And they had a history of feeling that way.
Well, if things had been different, do you think that Afghanistan might have turned out a little better than it is right now? Or would the Taliban still have made their recovery and come back as strong as they have?
Mm-hmm. I get this question a lot, and it's obviously very difficult to do these what-if scenarios. But I have to think that it would have been different. I do think that a lot of what's happened over there is all about hearts and minds. And is all about what was happening in the very beginning. And if we had more focus on it in the very beginning, more focus on actually getting development done, the idea of fighting a 10-year war versus 10 one-year wars and having an actual plan for what we were trying to do there, I think things could have been different. Things could have been better now.
We've been told it's dangerous for translators to work with foreign journalists. How did you find Farouk, your translator?
Farouk, who is a main character in the book, was provided to me by my predecessor, Liz Sly, who was there before. And she just basically told me, she gave me all this advice about going into India and all this advice about going into Pakistan and who I should work with, what I should do, what I should be careful of. And she said to me, Afghanistan, just listen to Farouk. He knows everything. And that's pretty much what I did. And we became very good friends. And he's, you know, somebody I first worked with in March of 2003. And we worked together solidly. We fought together. We, you know, became very close. I'm now known as Auntie by his children.
Well, you went to his wedding, didn't
you? Oh, yes. I went to his wedding. One of the first things I did was go to his wedding. And it was one of those hilarious me and Farouk interactions where I say to him, what should I wear to the wedding? And he looks me up and down, and I'm wearing like this baggy, awful green shirt and these baggy black pants and black tennis shoes, and my hair's been mashed under a headscarf all day, and I've got no makeup on. And he says, what you're wearing is just fine. So I think it's just fine, and I go there, and it's segregated, an Afghan wedding. Most Afghan weddings are still segregated. So I'm sitting with the women. There's basically nobody who speaks English on that side, and they're all wearing these gorgeous jeweled gowns, you know, their beautiful hair, their makeup's all done, and there I'm sitting there looking like, you know, a rube from the countryside.
The ugly American.
Exactly. And then he came in. He was, you know, at a certain point, the bride and the groom come into the women's side just like they go into the men's side. And they took pictures. And he's calling me up on stage. And I'm just whispering to him, why didn't you tell me I should dress up? And he says, oh, you're an American. They're used to it.
My guest is Kim Barker. Her book, The Taliban Shuffle, Strange Days in Afghanistan and Pakistan. You were mostly in Kabul.
Yes.
You did go to Kandahar. Was that a very different world?
Yes. I mean, Kabul is a very different world than the rest of Afghanistan. And but you have to be based in one particular place. And so when I was—
And it's the capital.
It is the capital, and it makes it easier to go other places. It's also, frankly, safer. And, you know, that's where Farouk was based as well. But, yes, when I went to Kandahar, it's very different in Kandahar. It's much more tense. It's in the south. It's always been a stronghold of a more conservative Pashtun culture and a stronghold of the Taliban.
And you had to wear a burqa when you went there?
Yes, Farouk made
me
wear a burqa.
You hadn't worn a burqa at all in Kabul?
No, because I would wear headscarves and I would wear, you know, I'd sometimes cover up my nose so that you could only see my eyes when we were driving in more dangerous areas, say in Khost, for example. But I had never worn a burqa before. And it was very difficult for Farouk to have to ask me. This was in June of 2006, and Farouk had been so proud. He's a Pashtun man, and he had been so proud that his female members of his family took off their burqas after the Taliban fled. He really wanted that. And so it was difficult for him to say, you know, Kim, I need you to wear a burqa on this trip. And I said, well, you know, whatever you think is safe. And he went to pick me up a burqa and brought it to me. And unfortunately, he brought me in a burqa that hit me in the back of my knee and was way too short in front. And so it was basically the equivalent of wearing a miniskirt in Kandahar.
At that point, had the Taliban already started making a comeback?
Definitely. It was in 2006 when they were pushing back, and we were finding people all over the place that were talking about how they were afraid to be seen as supporting the government. There was one particular funeral of a pro-government cleric that only four people came to, and I believe two of them were the gravediggers. And it was just really a sense that things were shifting at that particular point in time.
And as an American woman, were you safe there?
I always felt safe in Pakistan and Afghanistan. Maybe a little bit later I would realize that was a pretty stupid thing to do, but I always sort of trusted the hospitality there and that the people I was with would take care of me. Otherwise, you could never do that job. If you went around in fear all the time, you shouldn't be over there doing that job.
But people also talk about being addicted to the adrenaline rush that a certain amount of fear is automatically going to happen to you.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and I write about that as well. I definitely got addicted to it. I got addicted to the whole idea that this was such an important story that everything we were doing somehow mattered and more than anything else back in the States.
And what happened? Did you did all of your articles, were they all published as you wrote them? Do you think they were given the kind of importance that you thought they had?
I mean, the thing about the Tribune that was great is we weren't the New York Times. I didn't have to write every single story that happened. I got time to do more enterprise stories. And I think, you know, at least in the first few years I was over there, they really understood that this was an important story. They had somebody there, and I would do different stories. And I would get really good play from them. As time went on, though, that changed. I mean, and that happened in newspapers across the country.
Well, Afghanistan kind of disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
You were
mm-hmm.
in Kabul for the parliamentary elections in 2005, it had a really long ballot, didn't it?
Yeah.
But were people hopeful? Was there a sense of the country that that things were changing for the better, that progress was really being made?
Well, in the beginning, most definitely, when I first went there in 2002, I mean, I was greeted on the streets by women who hugged me and said, thank Bush for me, and men who shook my hand. And even in 2004, when Karzai was elected president, there was just very much a sense of things are going in the right direction, despite the decampment to Iraq. And in 2005, things started to change. I think the parliamentary elections, by the time that happened, people were feeling very disillusioned. They were feeling like the warlords that they had hated for so long had not been disenfranchised at all by what was happening there, that in fact they were being empowered. And the parliamentary election was really a case where you could see that.
And why were they being empowered? Was it just easier for the Karzai government to go to the people who already knew how to do things?
Yeah, it was very much easier for the Karzai government, and it was very much easier for the West. I mean, here was a strongman who could deliver what he promised. And I don't think the West or Karzai really thought about what that meant in these particular areas, what it meant to empower these men that were so hated.
My guest is Kim Barker. Her book, The Taliban Shuffle, Strange Days in Afghanistan and Pakistan. It is published by Doubleday. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Kim Barker, who joined the Chicago Tribune in 2001 and was the South Asia Bureau Chief from 2004 to 2009. She also held the 2009-2010 Council on Foreign Relations prestigious Edward R. Murrow Press Fellowship and currently working at ProPublica. She's written a book called The Taliban Shuffle, Strange Days in Afghanistan and Pakistan, which is published by Doubleday. This book is also about a lot of the people you met.
Right.
We talked about Farouk, but what about Abdul Jabbar Sabit? Sabit, okay.
Yes.
Well, my Pakistani is really bad. How did you meet him?
I met Sabit actually in Afghanistan at the office of the spokesman of the interior minister. And he was this incredibly imposing Pashtun in his 60s with this crazy white long beard and white flowing hair. And at the same time, he wore these very bespoke Western suits.
And then he told you what he thought was going on?
Well, he was, you know, he was a lawyer, and he ran sort of his own little fiefdom in the Interior Ministry, which he saw as taking on vice that he saw spreading in Kabul. And so he actually invited me to go out on raids of brothels in Kabul with him.
What about those brothels? I always thought that Afghanistan was a very conservative country.
It is a very conservative country, but one of the things that came with Westerners going into Kabul particularly was the spread of brothels, and it was not local women working there. It was primarily Chinese and women from the former Soviet Union.
And who was running them, foreigners?
Usually foreigners, yes.
So the Afghan men were not going there?
Allegedly they were not supposed to go there, but of course, you know, you always find a way, right?
This man, Abdul Jabbar Sabit, did we say?
Sabit, yeah.
He became the Attorney General of Afghanistan.
He then became the Attorney General of Afghanistan. And that was interesting because I had watched him over more than a year, and we had become like, yeah, I referred to him as a bit like my crazy Afghan grandpa. But he was, you know, a source of mine as well, although I stopped quoting him because we did become more friendly. And so that's always awkward as a journalist.
And was he able to resist the temptations of corruption that have affected so much of Afghani politics?
Well, after he became Attorney General, I actually had to cut off contact with him shortly after because it just became an uncomfortable acquaintance for me to have. And then over the next few months as he was Attorney General, different local journalists dug into what he was doing, and I talked to him about it later as well. And he succumbed to what a lot of Afghan officials succumb to over there, which is the whole, you know, getting land given to you, getting loans given to you. And there was lots of allegations swirling around about him. He definitely, while seen as this sort of man who fought corruption and prided himself on fighting corruption, he was seen as somebody who then started using the office for his family's gain and taking on people that he personally did not like.
Similar things happened with the Karzai family.
Exactly, exactly.
Was he seen as a positive development when he became president initially?
Most definitely. Just like Sabit was seen very positive when he became Attorney General. And it's something I use Sabit in a way to show how people's views changed about the Afghan government. He was a microcosm for that. But the same thing happened with Karzai. Karzai's brother in southern Afghanistan, Ahmad Wali Karzai, was seen as the power broker down there. Many people accused him of not necessarily drug trafficking himself, but allowing and profiting from the traffic of drugs.
And many people were taken with him initially, foreigners, because he was a very sophisticated man.
He speaks English. We love it when people speak English.
And it's only later that people realize what he was up to?
Well, you know, when we have to separate President Karzai from his brothers. He had the brother in the south and then the other brother that was seen as profiting from business deals. What Afghan said is, if a man can't control his brothers, how can he possibly run Afghanistan?
But isn't this the way of politics in the region in general? You were in Pakistan. I don't want to go to Benazir Bhutto yet, but you were there when she returned.
Sure.
And one of the reasons she was pushed out of office in the first place was because there were complaints about her husband and corruption.
Sure.
He's now the president of Pakistan.
Absolutely he is. I mean, in Afghanistan, yes. I mean, this is a common complaint, especially when a country is trying to establish some sort of government after so many years of war. I think that Afghans would be very willing to forgive these allegations of corruption if they saw something personally from it, if they saw services. You know, everybody's okay with a little bit of graft here and there as long as they get the power, as long as they see some sort of benefit from these billions of dollars coming in. And a lot of people just didn't see that.
When you were in Kandahar, you met a man named Mohammed Akbar Kakhrizwal.
Kakhrizwal, yes.
Who was he?
He was a tribal elder in the Alakazai tribe in Kandahar, and he was the former intelligence chief in Kandahar province for 4 years. He served as that under Karzai. He was also the brother of a police chief in both Kandahar and Kabul who had been blown up in a mosque attack.
These are good people to meet because they can tell you all sorts of things you wouldn't find out otherwise. And he told you a lot about tribal alliances, but also about the ISI and their role that's Pakistan's spy agency, their role in what was going on in Afghanistan?
Yes. I mean, Kandahar is very close to the border with Pakistan. And what Cockrizewald explained to us is, look, you know, while I was intelligence chief, I would work on American for 6 months. I would get him to know who was the good people, who was the bad people. I'm using broken English, much like Farouk. I start quoting him at a certain point. And, you know, and the American would never fully, as soon as they fully understood what was going on, they would leave and they'd be replaced by another American. Whereas the ISI folks, they had known the same guys for 27 years, you know, so they had a sense that Pakistan was around for the long haul, that maybe America wasn't necessarily there for the long haul.
We had a friend in Kandahar, Sarah Chase, mm-hmm. who said that one of her problems when she was a reporter was that she was constantly putting responsibility for so many of the troubles of Afghanistan on Pakistan and the ISI, and the people in the United States didn't want to hear that. But
right.
She seemed to think that Pakistan was benefiting from all the problems that Afghanistan was facing. We knew earlier that the ISI had helped the Taliban.
Right. I don't know that Pakistan necessarily benefited from all the problems, the chaos that was happening after the initial U.S.-backed invasion there. I mean, you could argue that they've had a blowback in Pakistan. But I do believe that Pakistan wants a government running Afghanistan that they see as friendly to their interests, not to India's interests. And they see the Taliban as friendly.
So this is also a proxy war?
It's turned into a proxy war.
Because India mm-hmm. has really tried to befriend Afghanistan?
I mean, India and the Karzai government are very close. I don't know that India is necessarily – it's not like they're fighting on the ground there, but they both back whoever they think is going to support their particular interests.
My guess
just
is –
just like Kashmir.
Kim Barker, whose book, The Taliban Shuffle, Strange Days in Afghanistan and Pakistan, published by Doubleday. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You also embedded with troops in Helmand province?
Yes.
That's where the drug trade thrives, isn't it?
Yes, it is. That has been the epicenter for the drug trade and also for the insurgents since the very beginning.
So does the U.S. Army do anything about all the opium farming?
They've gone back and forth as to what they should do. And the position of the U.S. sometimes differs from the position of NATO. So you have in some circumstances, the U.S. wants to take on the poppy trade and NATO doesn't want to take on the poppy trade. And there's this push and pull there because if you destroy these poppies, are you going to turn more people against what you're trying to do there? And in some circumstances, it's led to these strange things where, for instance, the British at one point in Helmand put out a radio ad basically telling everybody, hey, we're not the people who are destroying your poppies. We're not doing that. Basically putting the onus on that on the Afghan soldiers, which is difficult.
Well, that also hurts the Afghan cause, doesn't
yes.
it? Because the Taliban have actually been involved in the drug trade,
mm-hmm.
And they're buying the poppies from the farmers. So that would make the farmers a little more amenable to the Taliban, wouldn't it?
Well, yes, of course. I mean, and I think that any time you've got drugs going on, it just sows instability, which benefits the Taliban or insurgents in any place.
The other day, we had someone here who had just come back from Afghanistan, and he said, the poppies are blooming right now, and if you walk through the fields, you get a little bit of a high just from what I guess the pollen that's out there.
Yeah, so I hear. I've never done that, of course.
but you say Helmand was a place that everybody envied you for being embedded in.
Yes, when I went there, it was June of 2006 again, and it was shortly after the Americans had set up this brand new base at Musa Qala, and it was like this push that the West was doing to try to gain control in some insurgent areas at the same time they were transferring control from the Americans to NATO countries.
You visited a clinic there?
I did.
That was built through a U.S. program?
Mm-hmm.
Was that a success?
Well, it was still standing, which I guess you could say it's a successful building.
Because there have been a number of reports that things that we're building to – to make the Afghans love us, are really more American than they are Afghan. I saw a documentary recently in which a little park was built in the middle of a village, and the Marines were very disappointed. Nobody wanted to sit on the benches.
Yeah, it's fair. It's very true, and it's sad in a way because you feel like these were built with the best of intentions. The schools and clinics program aimed to, you know, build schools and clinics across Afghanistan, but it wasn't necessarily thought through in, as to whether they were going in the right places or whether there was actually teachers to teach there, or in this particular clinic, whether there was doctors or medicine. So, you know, I was with these soldiers who asked, look, are you using the school? And they're saying, well, you know, are you using the clinic? Well, you know, we don't have doctors and we don't have medicine. So
we have a building.
We have a building. You know, you can sit on it and hold meetings in it, but it's not a clinic.
Were you coming back and forth? Were you going to Chicago and then going back? Or did you pretty much stay in the area most of these years?
I pretty much stayed in the area. We got home leave every 2 years, and I generally only came home when I got home leave.
So you must have had how did you develop any kind of a personal life here? It's hard to meet people under these circumstances.
In Afghanistan and Pakistan? Or in the
wherever.
States? Well, no, it's actually very easy to meet people in Afghanistan and Pakistan because there's a whole collection of foreigners just like you, journalists, aid workers, people, you know, who are looking to make a quick buck.
So it's foreign journalists.
Yeah.
Foreign journalists.
It's foreign journalists. It's also aid workers. It's this whole UN group. It's this whole group of expats. But then, you know, in Pakistan and Afghanistan, you make local friends as well through, you know, doing interviews and meeting people. And I had no problem meeting people in either country and having a social life. It's a weird social life, but it's a social life.
At one point, Nawaz Sharif, the former prime minister of Pakistan, started pursuing you romantically, you write.
Yeah, yeah.
Were you aware of his intentions at first?
I was not aware of his intentions. I considered many people I met just to be an official who you're interviewing. I tended to joke around with people when I interview them, just like I joke around with people in real life. And I think that he misinterpreted that joking around. So after a few months after we met, offered to find me a friend. And I did not think that he met himself, but later it turned out that was the case.
Was reporting in Pakistan very different from Afghanistan?
Yes, it was very different than in Afghanistan, primarily because Pakistan's a country. It's got a government. It's functioning. And there are layers of red tape there that have been around since the time of the British. They perfected it, really. So it was much more difficult to get in with people in Pakistan. There were many more rules. And in Afghanistan, it was just much more like the Wild West. You could pretty much get in with anybody.
You arrived in Pakistan to report on President Musharraf's suspension of the Chief Justice.
Mm-hmm.
The people who are protesting were mostly lawyers who, to Americans, seemed rather heroic until I read what their beliefs were.
Well, that's been recently, and that's
not
all of the
lawyers. But these are the same
lawyers. Well, it's not all of the same lawyers, because most definitely at the time, none of the lawyers I was talking to, none of the lawyers at the forefront of the lawyers' movement in 2007 believed that it was a good thing to gun down the governor of Punjab. I'm assuming that's what you're referring to.
Among other things.
They thought
that the man who shared atomic secrets with North Korea and everywhere else was a hero. Should not be
some of them, but I think I think that that's generalizing. I think that that is generalizing, saying all lawyers believe that. I mean, one of the top lawyers who was defending the legal movement was Tammy, a woman who's in my book, and her brother-in-law was the governor of Punjab who was gunned down in January. And a lot of the folks who were running that movement were very liberal. But as with anything, there's going to be this dichotomy in Pakistan. It's a country of extremes where you've got very conservative people and very liberal people. And sometimes their concerns align, like with the legal movement, and sometimes they totally diverge.
And you moved to Islamabad
mm-hmm.
for a time?
Yes, I did.
What's that city like? It's kind of like Brasilia, isn't it?
Right. It's like this artificial city that was built in the 60s. A former U.S. ambassador referred to it as being half the size of Arlington National Cemetery and twice as dead. And it was, you know, it's a city of wide boulevards and manicured lawns. It doesn't look anything like the rest of Pakistan. It's beautiful.
Were you able to find a driver as helpful as Farouk had been?
Yeah, most definitely. That was Samad. And he basically occupied the role, main role for me in Pakistan that Farouk had for me in Afghanistan, taking care of me, making sure I didn't leave my passport in strange offices.
And that you had money.
And then I had money.
And an ATM machine.
Yeah, exactly.
Can you explain the test question that you used in Pakistan?
At a certain point when I was getting very frustrated with what I saw happening there, I started asking if people believed that any Jews died in 9/11. And that became my litmus test for whether I felt like what the person was telling me could be true or was just another crazy conspiracy theory.
And what did most people tell you?
Most people thought no Jews died in 9/11, which was
something the Mossad had arranged?
Some people believe that. Others believe a consortium of different groups were involved. And it was difficult for me. I think that would be difficult for any American because, I was a reporter at that point as well for the Chicago Tribune working off the Metro desk. And my main job was calling victims and asking them about what had happened. And I knew so many families
who had
suffered.
Well, what happened when you did follow up and said, but look at the people who were – who had hijacked the planes and where they came from, did that just not mean anything?
Well, they didn't. They just didn't believe it. They believed the whole thing was a conspiracy. And I remember the one guy that I write about in the book, he told me that the Jews should put up a list of the dead online and then maybe he would believe it. And I just said to him, you want the Jews to put up a list of the dead? And he said, yes. And I said, yeah, I'm out of here. I just, there's no point.
Actually, there are lists and he would find out
exactly.
That there were Jews who died.
Yeah, right.
You were there in Islamabad when Benazir Bhutto returned.
Yes.
Was that a time that the country felt as violent as Afghanistan?
Pakistan always felt as violent as Afghanistan. Pakistan always felt much more dangerous to me than Afghanistan. Well,
even though it's a country with established institutions.
Yes.
And you covered a bombing of her homecoming parade, which was just before she was killed.
Yes.
I would assume that was a very scary time for you.
It was a very scary time. I think it was a very scary time for Pakistan. We had gone to Karachi to cover her return, and it was initially this really joyful thing, where you had throngs of thousands of people around these vehicles, and people were dancing and singing, and we all the foreign journalists left somewhere around 9-10 o'clock. To write our stories and then to rejoin the procession. And the explosion happened at that point. And so I went rushing out there, couldn't even get a taxi to take me out there. There was no security tape guarding the scene. There was no sense of any semblance of order. I was invited over to look at the head of a bomber. I was invited on top of Benazir's truck to see what had happened. I mean, there was no sense of there should be evidence here. There should be something, official going on.
Was the ISI controlling?
Controlling that particular scene?
Well,
No.
Were you allowed to report on anything you wanted to?
Oh, you mean in Pakistan in general? No, I was not allowed to report on anything I wanted to.
A lot of people, other reporters, were trying to meet with the Taliban. Were you ever tempted to do that?
My feeling at a certain – I wanted to meet with the Taliban in the very beginning before the kidnapping started. But then once friends of mine started getting kidnapped and friends of mine started disappearing into their clutches one of my translators that I'd used at one point had his head cut off, Farouk and I just decided it's not worth it. No story is worth it. So we met with the Taliban in jail, and then we talked to them over the phone and also on instant chat. There was one spokesman that actually would get on AOL instant chat with us and talk.
When President Obama announced a troop surge in Afghanistan, did you think that it would be able to stabilize the country and get rid of the Taliban once and for all?
You had hoped, but I didn't think that it was enough or that it was long enough or that, this whole idea of going in and saying we're going to put 30,000 troops more in there and then we're going to start pulling out in July 2011, I think sent this really mixed message to the region. And what people heard there was July 2011.
We're going to declare victory on July in 4 months.
Right, exactly.
And then start pulling out, but who knows for how long.
Right. Well, and I think what we decided was we're going to push that date back a little bit to 2014.
Just one more question. You said that in some ways, Afghanistan reminded you of your home state, Montana.
Right.
How?
Well, as I write, I say, you know, it had big mountains, huge skies, and men with long beards and pickup trucks who drove around with guns in their in the back of their trucks and hated the government. So something my family really loved that description in the book.
Well, now you live here in New York.
Right, exactly.
Kim Barker's book, The Taliban Shuffle, Strange Days in Afghanistan and Pakistan, is published by Doubleday. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks very much for having me.